He said, it's better to listen with your mind than listen with your ears, but better still is to listen with your chi. The ears only record sounds. The mind can only analyze and categorize, but the chi is empty and receptive.
Usually we bring you part two conversations after the first one is aired, but this discussion is a little bit different. It will still be a month or so before the discussion with Rebecca Avern on using acupuncture to treat children is aired on the mainstream. But at the very end of recording that discussion, we realized that we'd already started treading into some new territory on the privilege and burden of doing a practice, along with the importance of being able to sit with large and not easy to answer questions. So we got together again, recorded this conversation that touches on how the luminous will at times arise in the interactions that you have with your patients and how much we can learn when we listen with a linghua, with a flexible and a lively heart. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Hey, Rebecca, welcome back to Chiological.
Thanks, Michael. It's really nice to be here again.
Yes, we were together, well, you know, in real time just a couple of days ago. Of course, on the podcast, these shows come out, you know, at different times because of publication schedules. But it was interesting. At the end of our conversation, we started having another conversation, which was like, oh my God, we got to turn the record button back on. Of course, a couple of days have gone by since we did that, but we're going to pick that conversation back up. And what I recall we were talking about, what kicked this off, is that both of us we're talking about our situations here in the COVID-19 time, how we've not been seeing patients, and what a relief that has been. That it's actually been great to step away from practice, which goes against the narrative of what most of our community is talking about.
Yeah. So I think we both acknowledged that we feel that we love our work and we love seeing patients and all the rest of it. But at the same time, I think it was interesting for both of us to also verbalize that we feel an unburdening in this time when we're not with our patients and that we have ambivalent feelings about starting up again. And then we began talking about what might be at the root of that. But actually, there was another spark for our conversation where you said that you developed the skills that you have to do the podcast through being with your patients, and how you feel what you most give to your patients is yourself, mm-hmm. I guess you were saying.
Yes. Do I give myself? Yes, I feel like I do. And that's partly why in this period of time where I have this, both the privilege of being an acupuncturist, but also the opportunity to not practice for a moment and recognize that, wow, caring for other people takes a lot out of me.
Yeah.
Right? There's I don't know if I'd say price that we pay, but maybe, well, let's play with that. There's kind of a price that we pay for caring. It's a price I'm willing to pay.
Yes.
It kind of goes with the territory. It's just that I didn't know that I was paying that price.
That's right. Well, and that's one of the gifts of this sort of pause, isn't it? The time to reflect and make these realizations. And I think we also said, and I feel this is very important, that we perhaps don't talk about this enough as a profession. So that was one thing that maybe we could come back to. But also for myself, I hope that this might enable me to some degree anyway to reset a little bit how I practice and how I am with my patients, so that perhaps when I start back, I pay less of a price.
Yes, we're gonna circle back and talk about that in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I want to circle back and talk about this thing about like learning to talk on a podcast and ask questions and how that comes out of my clinical practice, because we were talking about this the other day. And the reason that I have developed this is because in many ways, I'm not very good at certain things with Chinese medicine. I'm not a great diagnostician. All right. It's very difficult for me to like sort people into the buckets of the various diagnoses and go, oh yeah, well that's, you know, that's spleen yang deficiency, or that's kidney, you know, kidney fire being smolder, you know, whatever.
Sure.
You know, we've got all these different kinds of diagnoses. And I find that when I am like sorting through my mental models, what's going on with this person? I don't do it very well. And I don't feel like my treatments are that good. And I often feel like I'm kind of making something up because of a story I put together in my head. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've found that if I could just hang with a person long enough, talk to them in a way that was engaging, sometimes it's just a matter of sitting and waiting, that eventually the patient would say something. And I would hear it as, this is what's going on for me and this is what I need help with.
Yes.
And it's rarely the thing of like, well, you know, my knee hurts and I need my knee fixed. That's the thing that brings them in the office. But what's going on behind that knee, sometimes I've got to wait. And like, and the way that I say it to myself is, I'm waiting for them to tell me what to do. I'm waiting for them to tell me what to do. When I think about, here's what I need to do, sometimes I'm right, often I'm not. But when I can hear and feel viscerally them telling me, this is what I need, then I know where to go. And then it can fall into a Chinese medicine diagnosis very quickly.
So I think what's really interesting, there are lots of interesting things in that. But one of them is, you started out by saying that you don't feel that you're a very good diagnostician, or that you can necessarily easily put patterns of imbalance onto a person and absolutely know with clarity that that's what's going on. But mm-hmm. that makes me wonder whether your expectation, or our expectation as acupuncturists, that that is what we should be doing, is perhaps not quite right.
Well, think about this for a moment, okay? So when I think about like the emblematic practitioner, all right, and this is just my background and my proclivities and all that. The emblematic practitioner is that scholar practitioner. It's like that person who studied, they know a lot, they have a lot of experience, but mainly they know a lot. And they're very good with pulse, so they could ask a question or two, and they feel the pulse, and it's like, yes, it's this. I am so far away from that. I'm like the opposite of that.
Yeah. But,
and yet, that's the image I have in my mind of what a great practitioner is supposed to be. But so, I can't do it.
So I wonder, do you know where that image comes from? Why that is your image of the sort of ultimate practitioner?
You know, that's a great question. You should do a podcast. So I think in part it comes from that I do enjoy using my mind, and I do enjoy feeling like I have some knowledge and understanding. That's just, I think that just goes with my personality. I kind of cotton to that aspect. The other piece is Chinese medicine has this long tradition, and we often hold up these practitioners from the past as being these like emblematic, you know, they're like gods.
Yes.
Almost, right? Zhang Zhongjing, Li Dongyuan, you know, Zhu Danqi,
yes.
Sun Simiao, right? There's all these, like, we have this pantheon of
yes.
Chinese medicine gods, as it were. And so that becomes like the archetype that I, you know, as a young student and practitioner, well, I wasn't young when I studied, but, you know, as a beginning student practitioner, I think I just kind of impressed that on my psyche. That's how you're supposed to be. That's how a good doctor works. And plenty of people hold, it's like as a profession, we hold those people in esteem.
Yes, we really do, don't we?
Yes.
We really do. And when we learn, when we study, we inevitably have to go into our minds and our intellects in order to understand and memorize the theory. Mm. So perhaps there's something about going, about needing to do that in order to study, to be practitioners, that makes it hard for us to then come away from that when we're actually with our patients. I actually, in the couple of days since we last chatted, I remembered a quote that I've written down, a Confucius quote, which really comes to mind when you described how if you wait, your patient will tell you what you need to know. Mm-hmm. Can I read the quote to you?
Mm.
He said, "It's better to listen with your mind than listen with your ears, but better still is to listen with your chi. The ears only record sounds. The mind can only analyze and categorize, but the chi is empty and receptive." And I wonder whether what you were saying there is that when your chi is in an empty and receptive enough place, then you hear the message that your patient needs you to hear.
That's it. That's right.
But what's interesting perhaps is that you and I definitely feel the same. We don't necessarily believe or feel that we are a good enough practitioner, or good enough in inverted commas, mm-hmm. for working that way.
Yes, the mind sets this kind of bar that says this is how it should be. But as I hear you speak that quote, it lands with a certain kind of truth.
Yeah.
I mean, it just lands with that sense of, oh, that's right. So now that I know that that's also part of the picture, and it also doesn't hurt that a luminary from the past said it.
No, that helps our case.
Helps our case. I'm in good company. It's true that there's that emptiness piece. This is something that I find so fascinating about practice. It is our job to do something to help people. That's the agreement that we have. That's why they're coming in. That's why we work hard at our craft.
Yes.
And yet it's that there's this element of being empty. There's this element of receptivity, sort of an uwe, like a non-doing, that also needs to be present. If that's present, if that allows something to come through, then we know what to do.
Yes.
It's like we're skillful, but it's not our mind that's being skillful. Mm-hmm. It there's something in that interaction. It's like the chi is being skillful.
Exactly. And I think it's really important that our minds have what they have underneath that. I remember really clearly when I was studying acupuncture, it was early on in my studies, so it was about 23 years ago, and I was having treatment, and I was an annoying acupuncture student patient who thought when I went into the room that I knew what I needed. And I remember my practitioner pausing for a while and not really saying much and umming and ahhing, and then putting a needle in what I later found out was gallbladder 24. And I said to her with my acupuncture student head on, "Well, why have you used that point? Because there's nothing wrong with my gallbladder chi," kind of thing. And she said to me, "I really felt that was the point that you needed." And sure enough, I remember feeling fantastic after that treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think if she had just taken my pearls, looked in the textbooks, listened to my signs and symptoms, she would not have used gallbladder 24. And it's only really years later that I realize that she was listening with her chi. And I probably inadvertently told her in some way that that was the point that I needed.
That sounds right. And I think the other piece that's also right about this is all the study that we do, all the memorization, all the mental models, all the nuts and bolts, the various pieces, the theories, the ideas for treatment. We need all of that.
Definitely.
You can't practice without it. You can't just go, oh, I think a needle goes here.
No.
I don't think you can do that. It's like a musician needs to know their scales forwards, backwards, upside down, this key, this rhythm, that tempo. And then you can really start playing some music.
Yeah.
So it's like the stuff has to be in there.
Yeah.
But held lightly.
I think the musician analogy is a really good one. When we're playing music, we're not thinking of those scales that we spent hours perfecting. But yet, because we did that, they're strongly informing how we're playing in the moment.
Musicians listen with their chi. That, I think it's one of the reasons why people love music and love live music in particular.
Yeah,
because it is being in the presence of people listening with their chi.
Yes.
And using their mind, you know, and using all the incredible skill that they've developed over time.
Yeah. And maybe when you're with your patient and you have to wait a while to hear what they're trying to tell you they want from you, you're not in that moment aware of the years of study and expertise that you've developed beforehand, which leaves you in that position that you can then give you what you need. And maybe that's a small part of, well, of the burden in some way, because maybe it brings up a feeling of you being a fraud or not good enough or shame or something like that. I don't know whether the two are connected, but I suspect they probably are.
So, and we spoke about this the other day, or I'm going to circle this back in. I've been at this 20-ish years. You've been at this 20-ish years. And we were talking about, you know, it's like, and what do you do when you're in clinic and you feel like, I got no idea what's going on? Or I'm wrong. You know, you were talking about that moment when you ask how a patient's doing and they say, well, actually it's not gone well.
Yeah.
Right. And how does your heart not sink in a moment like that? And how do we stay present in a moment like that? Because I don't know anyone who doesn't feel it as kind of a hit. And, you know, as a practitioner, we learn to sort of absorb that and go, okay, I got a little ego involved and I'm sorry that it's like that. And, oh man, I was wrong. That was too bad. We've got our own stuff around that. And then there's, you know, how you respond to it, which I think is the key to really being a pro.
Yes, because we have to balance it, don't we? If we didn't have a heart sink, if it didn't affect us, we probably wouldn't be very good healers. But at the same time, when in that moment, the heart sink is so great that we go into a complete swirl of emotion, then that also actually detracts from our ability to help the patient in front of us. Because I think when we're in those moments where it becomes clear that what we've done, it's hard to say it's the wrong thing, isn't it? Because there are so many factors in there.
Let's say it wasn't helpful.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. So when we know what we've done hasn't been helpful, I think what we most need in those moments is real clarity of mind, to be able to look back and see, we did something different last time. We forgot to treat that aspect, or we added in something new. Maybe that's not such a good thing. And to be able to think very lucidly about it. But the emotion that I think many of us experience in that moment means that we're less able to do that. So it's a question of how we hold the emotion, because we need to have the emotion, because that shows that we care. Mm-hmm. But we need to hold it without it then sort of leading the way, as it were. We need to somehow hold it, but just slightly to one side, or slightly put it on the back burner, while we then have clarity of decision to know what to do next.
So it's essential to the process.
I think so.
It's actually essential to the process that there's this part of us that goes, oh, and we feel the collapse. You can feel your chi collapse a bit. I think this is really what makes a professional is recognizing, oh, it's there. There's all the stories that go with it. There's all the reasons why it might be present. You can't not have it. How do I know you can't not have it? Because it's there. But I'm sure you've experienced this, and probably listeners have too. There are moments when we're pretty firm in who we are and what's going on. And we can take that kind of news and we just go, oh, okay, that wasn't so helpful.
Yes.
And we receive it without taking so much of a hit.
Yes.
But the trick, I think, in becoming a seasoned practitioner is recognizing when we do, and somehow staying present through the process.
Yes.
Like you say, put it a little off to the side, not deny it, not get rid of it, just enough off to the side so that we can stay present with the work that we're there to do.
Yeah. And you're right that we probably all have times when we're better at doing that than other times. And I think that partly depends on how we are on the day and what's going on in our lives. But I know for me, it also is very much influenced by the patient. And because I treat children, it's influenced not so much just by the patient, but by the parent as well. And the nature of them and their character and how I respond to that and the dynamic between us.
Yeah, we all have our unique kinds of pressures in clinic that we have to work with. I've heard it said that you know that you've come to kind of a space of equanimity when you can hear applause and you can hear boos and hisses and not feel like you are responding to either of them.
Yes.
That you can take either one. You can say, oh, you're so great. And it's like, it doesn't move you. And you can hear, you're so awful, and it doesn't move you.
Exactly. Because it's so easy, isn't it, to go for the days where everyone seems to be doing really well and to really let that affect our mood. But the more that does, then the more we'll be knocked on the bad days and in the bad moments.
We have to watch it on both sides.
We really do have to watch it on both sides. But at the same time, I feel that we need to be forgiving of ourselves when we do respond a bit more than perhaps is ideal. And I think as long as we recognize that we're doing it, then that's probably okay. Because then we're reflecting on it and we're learning from it. Because I personally feel fairly confident in saying that even if I practice for another 50 years, I think I'll still be swayed by the good days and the bad days. But I just feel that as each year goes by, I manage it a little bit better.
I would agree. We're human beings. We're emotional beings. It goes with the territory of being a human. And like you say, over time, if we're attentive, it can change.
Yes.
I have found, so on that other side, where, oh, things have been going really good. And I've like patted myself on the back. Oh, good job. You really got this. You know what you're doing. Blah, 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 blah. I know if I start going down that path that something's going to come along really soon and remind me that's not the case. And so now when people say that things are better, I don't just go, okay, good, they're better. I actually want to dig into that.
Yes.
And I use it as an opportunity to kind of check in, because I've got my own idea of what it means when they say they're better. But what I've come to discover over time is I actually have no idea unless I ask.
Yes.
And so when they say I'm better, I go, that's great. How do you know? And how do you know you're better?
Yeah. And what does that mean to you? It's as important as asking when they say they're not better, what's gone on, which we're probably more likely to do.
Exactly.
But I think that we're less likely to really examine the what does feeling better mean, because we don't want to, we feel that sort of vulnerable and we want to just keep it that they're better. Whereas if we then go into it more, we might actually find out that they're better because the day after the treatment, their partner did something lovely for them and it lifted their joy, or that a part of them's better and a part of them's not better. But again, the more we can detach from any of this better, worse, and anyway, are these concepts helpful? I mean, they're important on the one hand, aren't they? Because people come to us with a symptom initially, and it is our job to try to ease that symptom. But then I think what we're both probably saying is that as we go down the line of treatment with them, we unravel a whole lot more of the story, so mm-hmm. that symptom just then becomes one little character in a much bigger story.
Yes. Yes, it does. And so are we willing to get to know our patients at that level is one of the questions that comes up for me. Do they want to be known at that level? We need to respect. Sometimes people don't want to be known that well. They just want this thing fixed, but please don't bring the rest of me along. Yeah. We need to respect that as well.
Yeah.
And I have found there's that, and this is one of the reasons I asked that question about how do you know you're better? Because sometimes patients, they're not better. They just want to be a good patient, or they want you to feel good. So yes, I'm better.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're not.
Yeah.
And I want to know if that's true. And also, like you say, I love that perspective. Maybe their partner did something nice for them. Mm. And that's why they're better. It actually has nothing to do with what I was doing. It's something about the situation that they're in. Oh, maybe there's something about their relationship that actually needs to be attended to, you know, and or maybe the relationship is a strength that they could rely on.
Yes. And the same when people say they're not better, I think that we probably then assume that was because our treatment wasn't good enough. But we might then find out that actually they had a row with their partner the next day and it really discombobulated them. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I suppose it's what we're really saying is that we do need to take ourselves not out of the picture, but put ourselves and our treatment a little bit more into the background of the picture rather than the foreground. And maybe also that would help us to feel less burdened by our practices.
I think that's a really good point. And so often I will hear practitioners, and I've said it myself plenty of times. I've learned to do it less over the years, but there's this idea that, oh, their back pain's gone. I fixed them.
Yeah.
And maybe they just stopped doing something that was burdensome to them, or they stopped doing something that was injuring them. Mm. And they stopped doing something that was injuring them because they had a little more awareness. Let me give you an example. This was when I was I think I was just out of school or close to the end of school. This woman comes in, she'd been having one-sided headaches, and it was because she worked at a computer all day. She was a programmer, actually. And it turns out that after her acupuncture treatment, she went back to work and she felt fine. And she got like into her work again, and the headache came back. And as the headache came back, she realized that as she was moving her mouse, she was raising her elbow up in the air. It was a posture that she had. It was a habitual posture. She raised her elbow up and she went, "Oh, my elbow's up." And she just dropped her elbow. It's like, "Huh, that's weird and that's uncomfortable." She just dropped her elbow. The headache diminished. She gets back to work. She's into her programming. The headache is coming back and she notices, "Oh, the elbow's up in the air again." She drops her elbow. She goes through an afternoon of recognizing there's a posture that she gets into when she's furiously coding. And if she could just keep her elbow down, she wouldn't get the headaches. And it only took her an afternoon of that kind of attentiveness to get rid of it. So she comes back to the second treatment and goes, "I don't have headaches anymore." It was not because I got rid of her headache. It's because acupuncture gave her, for whatever reason, this awareness. And she goes, "Oh, I'm doing this to myself. I'll just stop doing it."
So did she perceive that the acupuncture was any part of her headaches getting better?
I don't remember.
No. I don't remember. Yeah.
Mm-mm.
I think that's a really lovely example of what I meant really by just putting ourselves in the background. You know, your treatment was the reason that her headaches stopped happening.
The treatment was helpful.
The treatment was helpful.
But she's the one who did it.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much about what we do to our patients. It's about what we can do for them and about how we are with them. That what actually brings about these wonderful changes.
It can.
Yes.
It doesn't always.
It doesn't always, of course. Yes.
But it, in my experience, I found it's more likely.
Yes. And I suspect that it was not only your needles that helped to bring about that awareness, but the way that you spoke to her and the space that you gave her to reflect herself on her headaches and what she was doing.
I was a student or brand new practitioner at the time. I think I think we get lucky a lot of times at the beginning. We'll have some experiences that are very fundamental, or maybe it's like a seed of who we can become.
Yes.
And I think it was just kind of a lucky moment that happened, and it has stuck with me.
Mm.
It's just one of those lucky moments that stick with you and you go, "Huh,
yes,
something about that."
And I think there is such thing as a sort of beginner's luck. Mm. And I don't like the word luck because it sounds as if therefore we have no agency in it. And I think we do, but I think that for a lot of new practitioners, they bring something to their practice that perhaps we begin to lose as we feel more confident in our knowledge and experience that enables them to have some really wonderful outcome.
I also think, this may sound a little weird, I also think the universe tends to be generous with us. And so for me, this has just been my life. Maybe I should say the way I've made sense of my life. I feel like sometimes at the beginning, I will have that beginner's luck. I will get a glimpse of what's possible.
Mm.
It's like the universe opens up. This is possible. I get an experience. I get a taste. And then the curtain closes. And you work for 20 years to get there.
Yeah.
There's a glimpse. You can see it. You know it's possible, even if you don't know how to do it yet.
Yeah. And that glimpse enables you to stick at it and to get through the difficult times and to keep going.
I think so.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I feel I had that glimpse the first time I ever had acupuncture as a patient. I went into my second treatment and I said to my practitioner, I'm sure everyone says this to you, but actually, I'd really like to study this, expecting her to say, oh, yes, everyone says that, you know, just I wouldn't think about that now. But actually, her response was, I think it would be wonderful if you studied it. And within 2 months, I was signed up on a course, but I got a glimpse of something happening within me that had never happened before. So I think we can have it as the practitioner, but as the patient as well.
Yes. Well, my suspicion is these experiences probably happen all the time in lots of different contexts. How do you make a decision at any moment in time? Oh, this is for me.
Yeah.
Right? There's other paths that you took before you became an acupuncturist. How did those decisions get made? Mm. Maybe something similar.
Yes.
There's a nudge. It's like there's a nudge.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a nudge at the right time, because I'm sure we all get nudges that we ignore at other times. But if we get the right nudge in the right way at the right time, that's when we really go more onto our true path, isn't it?
Well, and even in treatment, I'm thinking about, you know, how I listen in clinic and what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for the patient to give me a nudge. There's something in me that trusts certain kinds of nudges. I know it when I feel it. I would not call myself intuitive. And yet I know that there are certain moments where I go, oh, this, there's something here. Mm. And so in a way, in practice, yes, I'm waiting for my patients to nudge me in a certain direction. Now, there's something that I've started doing in my practice. This is fairly recent. It used to be I'd wait for the nudge, and then I look for all the other things that would help me to clarify the diagnosis. Oh, I kind of got the nudge, and there's this, and there's that, and oh yeah, it's this diagnosis here. Lately, I've been working it the opposite way around. I'll get the nudge, and I'll go, oh, maybe it's this. I want to prove it's not that. I'm going to look for all the bits of information that prove it's not what I think it is. Because then I'm not working out a confirmation bias and trying to make myself feel good about, oh yeah, and here's all the things that line up and therefore it's this. I try to prove it wrong. And if I can't prove it wrong, I'm more likely to be right about the diagnosis.
And how are you finding that way of working?
Fun. Number one, it's fun. I feel like I'm more playful with myself in clinic. And I'm a little bit more playful with the patient. I can ask them all kinds of weird ass questions because I'm trying to prove something wrong. They'll be like, why are you asking me that? No. Okay. Just checking. So it's more playful for me and it's more fun.
Yes.
I think it's more helpful as well. But it's more playful and fun for me.
Well, and again, going back to our original point, I suspect that having more play and fun in your practice enables you to be less burdened, less drained, and all the rest of it, and will also benefit your patients as well.
So far, so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So far, so good. I want to swing back to this burden piece because, as we were talking the other day and you brought that word up, I mean, it just lit me up like a pinball machine, because I had this experience, and I've spoken about this on the podcast. This was a month or so ago, of realizing that I'd been sleeping better since COVID and sleeping better since not seeing patients.
I heard you.
And it was like,
weird.
Yes. Yeah. It's like, that's weird. And the thought that arose in my mind was, yeah, I feel unburdened, which flipped me out. It's like, what do you mean burden? This isn't a burden. This is a privilege. Oh, but I feel unburdened. Oh, I need to sit with this. So for me, and I don't know if others out there caught into this or not, it's very easy to look at the side of, it's a privilege to do the work that I do. I feel like I'm doing helpful work in the world. It's not a bad way to make a livelihood. I get to help people. But I was only focusing on that, and I was completely not attending to how caring for others is also draining, to how hearing, no, that didn't help at all. It pulls some chi out of you.
Yes.
It takes some cultivation to go, ooh, it's lost a little chi.
Yes.
You know, stay present with this. And so I feel like this sense of burden. I don't think burden's a bad thing. I shoulder this burden willingly.
Yes.
I'm just delighted to have it out in the light and on the table, along with the privilege of doing the work. I'm very curious to see what it has to say to me now that I'm able to attend to it and listen to it.
Yeah. It's bringing it out from the shadows, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
And generally, the more things are in the shadows, the more power they have over us. And as you say, putting it on the table will shift something in it. I think for me, I have struggled with admitting that I have any kind of burden, because when I compare myself, particularly at the moment, to perhaps an ICU doctor who's dealing with people dying every day, I feel like I should not be allowed to, I'm not allowed to carry any burden, because what I do is just not nearly weighty enough. It's generally not life and death kind of stuff. But over this time, having reflected on that, what the sort of partial conclusion I've come to is that ties in with the fact that we don't in society give enough weight to the kind of healing that we do as acupuncturists. And I don't want to in any way diminish the incredible work of frontline doctors, which is phenomenal. And thank God there are people out there that can carry that burden. But that doesn't mean that we don't carry a different kind of burden, and it's more subtle. But having people in our clinic who reveal things to us that they've not revealed to anyone else, having them sit here for an hour or however long and talk about their innermost feelings is another kind of responsibility. And I think that we just don't really name it as such. I think that I am more unconsciously influenced by the zeitgeist of, oh, yes, we're just kind of flaky acupuncturists, you know, complementary medicine healers. I'm too influenced by that because, you know, damn it, we're not. What we do is really, really important. But it's harder to see the importance of what we do because we're working with chi.
Well, there's something else too, which is, and for me, this time of COVID is really bringing it to the fore, because everybody's like, ooh, this stuff could kill you. Death. Be careful. You could die. Well, guess what? You're going to die. We're all going to die. I mean, in some ways, nothing's different. Who dies more often? Old people die more often. Who dies more often? Sick people die more often. That's just life.
Sure. Yes.
That's how this goes. I'm not trying to be callous here. Because I know there's a whole side of the political spectrum that just says it's a hoax and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, in nature, who is more vulnerable to dying? Old, weak, and sick. That's kind of nature in a way. So I just want to name that and put it out there.
Yes.
We look at the, you know, quote, frontline doctors. Well, you know, it's life and death. There's a lot of focus on the death piece. And, oh, you know, someone could be dying. And so that's somehow more important than looking at how is it that we live.
Exactly.
Right? We talk about life and death and go, but we focus on the death. Oh, yeah, because someone could die. Well,
exactly.
But there's this other piece of focusing, how are we actually living? Are we living? How fully are we living?
And
how congruently are we living? And
yes,
that's the work that we do. And we do it much better than an emergency room doctor. Thank God there's emergency room doctors for emergencies.
Yes.
But the work we do and the work they do is different. It doesn't help to compare one as being better than the other or more important. The question with medicine is always, who needs what kind of medicine and at what time? What's the right medicine? If my leg's broken, it's the ER.
Yes.
If my heart's broken, it might be my acupuncturist.
You've said it so succinctly. Our job is to make life as good as it can be. It's not to help people avoid death, generally speaking.
It's not about avoiding death.
No.
And ideally, it's about not avoiding life.
Yes, well, quite. Exactly. It's about helping people to enter into the stream of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really it, isn't it? You know, you've just named what it is we do. And in naming it, when I hear you say that, it really reaffirms why I'm doing it. And yes, why sometimes I find it challenging, because, you know, for God's sake, if we can't have good lives, then what's the point? So it's such vital work.
Yes. So by the time we get to our death, we've had a life. My suspicion is one of the difficulties we have in the West with death is that it might be because we haven't more fully lived our life.
Yeah. And to get to the point of death with some knowing, however deep within us it is, that we haven't lived our life, would make us want to run away from it. I've got to do it now because I haven't done it up until now.
And at some point it does become too late.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting, really, that during this time of COVID, when, yes, the focus is on death and the fear of death, that the other side of that is that I'm also hearing so many conversations about this is enabling me to change my life.
Yes. I hear those conversations all over the place.
Yeah.
It's a very present conversation that just seems to be naturally emerging. People go, I'm not sure I want to continue working the way that I did. I need to shift this. Oh, I like that I'm seeing 8 patients a day instead of 20.
Yeah, quite. So it's being faced with death that is actually forcing many people to re-examine life.
It might be one of the benefits of this time.
I really hope so. I really hope so. Yeah.
But it's super challenging. I mean, if you've built a life, I mean, I'm thinking about mine now, like, oh gosh, how do I keep the props under this thing? Mm. I'm used to seeing X amount of patients a week. My lifestyle and my commitments require that I see that many patients a week. Mm. I like not seeing quite as many. What does that mean now about how my life might need to change?
Mm. Well, maybe you don't need to answer that question at the moment. Maybe, again, it's about just bearing that question, as it were, and then waiting for the nudge, because maybe you'll get a nudge. Life will give you a nudge that helps you to see the answer to that.
I love that phrase. Thank you. Bearing the question.
Well, I think when we come up with these questions, our mind immediately goes to, well, then I have to find the answer.
Mm-hmm. Which is what we do in clinic, right?
Yes.
Someone comes in, we're trying to find the answer.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Our conversation, it's life and clinic are, you know, the same. They're one and the same, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's what's so different about our medicine. We are bringing ourselves to our medicine in a way that is unique to, you know, certain kinds of healers. So I think it was Schweitzer that talked about, I can't remember the exact phrase, but something about medicine being about letting our own individuality interact with the individuality of our patient. So it's really about, it's about us. Having just said it shouldn't be about us, too much. We shouldn't be at the center of the picture. At the same time, as well as our needles, our medicine really, to a large degree, is about our individuality. And that's why, as acupuncturists, you know, we all lean towards treating different kinds of people and different kinds of ailments. And we're all very different with how we actually do it in our clinic. Whereas, and I hear what you said, that comparisons are generally unhelpful, but, you know, the emergency doctor looks at the machines and goes through the flow charts, and they probably all do it more similarly than we practice our medicine.
Well, I suspect for emergent conditions, there is triage and there are flow charts, and that can be really, really helpful in that context. Trying to put our patients into a flow chart might be not as helpful.
Well, I just don't think it would work, but maybe it's really helpful for those emergency situations, because how could you bring yourself to it and just sort of, you know, feel with your chi for the nudge of what's right to do? That's not the right kind of medicine for that situation.
No, they're going to look at, are they bleeding or not bleeding? Oh, they're bleeding. Okay, stop the bleeding.
Yeah. Have they got enough oxygen in their blood? Okay, no, we need to give them oxygen. But it just struck me as we made the comparison between our lives and our practice, and the two are so intertwined, because our medicine is partly about how we as an individual interact with our patient as an individual. Yeah. And the chi that emerges as a result of that, or the shifts in the patient's chi and our chi that emerge as a result of that.
I'm back to thinking what we said a little earlier about, you know, well, it's life and death. And so for an emergency room doctor, it really is about preventing death.
Yeah.
And they're good at it.
Yeah.
It is about preventing death. But our job is not about preventing death. Our job is about enhancing life, yangsheng, nourishing life.
Yes.
And they're two different medicines. I don't want to put one above the other.
No. They're just different.
They're just different, and they're needed at different times.
Exactly.
And for us, we have that, in a way, we do have that privilege of having some time and the ability to go slower. And we also have the challenge of, what actually is going on with this person?
Yeah.
You know, in an emergency room, it's usually pretty obvious. Oh, their heart stopped. All right, let's get to work on that. But in our work, it's a little more, I don't know if amorphous is the right word. It takes some time to kind of get to know the terrain. It's like we've been dropped off in a new country, or we've gone to visit a place that we've never visited before. And there's a terrain that we don't know what the landscape is.
Yeah.
So we need time to get to know that landscape of that person that we're trying to help.
Yeah. It brings to mind a little boy I was treating up until lockdown. I think I'd seen him 3 or 4 times, and he's 6 years old, I think, 5 or 6. And when he wakes up in the morning, he sneezes unremittingly for about 2 hours, and he sits in the classroom at school and just keep sneezing, and he was getting really anxious about going to school. And the reason he comes to my mind is because in the last treatment I had with him, I hadn't yet made any change, and I hadn't got that nudge. And I know in my mind he's got lots of damp, he's a very deficient child, but just treating the dampness and strengthening his chi hadn't done anything yet. And I know there's something else that I haven't yet seen about, as you say, the terrain. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of has struck me that I've had the time to just sit with that. Whereas in the, you know, in the busy week of a normal kind of clinic, I might not think about him between one treatment and the next. And so again, it's about, so for me anyway, one of the things I think I want to do differently is to create more space and see fewer patients so that I have this time to sort of sit with the terrain a little bit between treatments and just kind of feel my way into it more.
Sitting with the terrain. I love that term. Did I say that? I think I just said that.
Yeah, you said it.
I'm the one who said it.
I was using your...
All right.
I mean, I borrowed your phrase.
Every now and then I'll hear something and it's like, wait a minute, who said that? Did I say it? Did they say it?
You definitely said the terrain bit. I think I might have added the sitting bit. So we'll both take credit.
All right. So the thing about sitting with the terrain, it's getting to know who someone is and how they are and how we are with them. And at the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about the luminaries and how I've had in my mind that these scholar practitioners are the, you know, high essence of doctors. I suspect, and it's just a hunch after having this conversation, that when we hear about those great doctors, we're hearing about the cherry-picked moments of their life and their practice. We're hearing about the Instagram feed of
I love
Li Dongyuan, right?
Yes, we are.
Think about, it's like, so like Zhang Zhongjing, right? How did he find out about all the ways that herbs didn't work? Because they didn't flip and work.
Exactly.
Right? There's all these moments I suspect that the luminary practitioners of the past had, where it's like, they totally got it wrong. They missed it. They didn't have it. And I think that we forget that there were times they were probably scratching their head in much the way that we are and going, what's going on here?
Yes.
Every trick that I have doesn't work.
Yes.
Everything that I think I know about it doesn't work. And that's actually when these people learn something new that, adds to the knowledge of the medicine that we get to hear about. But we think that they were like that all the time. They weren't.
We think they just clicked their fingers and got there. But we learn from our failures. We don't learn from our successes. We don't learn anything from the patients that come back after one treatment saying, I feel fantastic. Everything's cleared up. We learn very little from that. The ones we really learn from are the ones where it's a lot harder to bring about a positive change.
I went to a parent-teacher conference last fall. Mm-hmm. My wife's niece from China lives with us and goes to school here. She's 15. And so we're sitting in the math class and the math teacher's, talking about here's what they do and here's what we're going to study and blah, blah, blah. But he had this great slideshow and he had these great quotes. And one of the quotes that he flashed up said, when you're getting the answer right, you're practicing. When you're getting it wrong, you're learning.
Ah, I like that. That's great.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that's not just true for mathematics. That is especially true for medicine.
Isn't it just? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the sort of Instagram Zhang Zhongjing. It's so true because I thought very hard when I wrote my book, I did not want to only include my successes in the case histories. And I have sometimes had a not very serious idea about writing a book of case histories of failures, gathering together practitioners' failures and putting them in a book. Because if we're really honest, as acupuncturists, we airbrush that out of our written material.
I think we should do it.
I think we should.
I think we should do it. There's a teacher that I had, I think in my second year of school, herbalist, really great herbalist. And he said that you can only say that you understand an herb or a formula when you've used it and it didn't work and you know why. And you've used it and it worked and you know why. You have to know why on both, why it did and why it didn't. And that's why the failures are so important.
Yeah. He was a wise teacher.
So it's not enough to have a failure, but you also have to know why. So a book of that kind of stuff.
Yes, with the learning that comes out of it. Not just a whole ream of this didn't work, but actually on reflection, I think this is why that didn't work.
That would take some nerve to be able to write that kind of thing up and share it in public.
Yeah.
That would be a very generous contribution of anybody who wanted to contribute to this work.
Yeah. And I think it's particularly hard for us to do as acupuncturists, perhaps because, rightly or wrongly, we are compared to other forms of medicine. We know that we are not taken seriously by a certain proportion of the population, and therefore we feel we have to exaggerate our successes and hide our failures.
Well, I would say that probably adds to the burden that we carry, especially if you're not aware that you're carrying it.
Yes, I have no doubt it does. I'm absolutely sure of that. I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know whether this is perhaps a bit different in the States, but in the UK, most people, the vast majority of patients, are paying out of their pocket for their acupuncture treatment. They don't get it on insurance. So there's then that added thing of we charge them, whereas they don't pay. In the UK, we don't pay for our medicine most of the time. We have the National Health Service. So that just adds to that burden.
Well, I know in the United States, some places it is covered by insurance. In other places, it's not.
Right.
I happen to live in a place where it's not.
Oh,
it's a true privilege to not have to take insurance, because I've noticed a couple things. When people are paying out of their own pocket, they listen more to what I have to say about how they might be able to get healthy again. It's very different when it's insurance. Well, you know, it's just insurance, you know, so what? When they're actually opening their wallet and leaving some money with me, they bring more of themselves to it. The other piece is I bring more of myself to it.
That's a really interesting perspective. So something I've seen as a potential negative, you're actually saying for you is a positive in many respects.
I think it's a huge positive.
Yeah.
When I took insurance, I used to live in Seattle. People would call. The first question was not, can you help me? The first question was, do you take my insurance? Over here, it's usually, can you help me?
Right.
A whole different conversation.
So maybe in the UK, we shouldn't be quite so keen on trying to persuade all the medical insurance companies to accept acupuncture.
I think there's good arguments on both sides.
I'm sure. Yeah.
One of the good arguments is, well, people that don't have the money, but if insurance covered it, they could get some treatment. I think there's some real good in that, but I tend to take care of my car better if I know that I want to try to keep it out of the repair shop.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So there's that.
Yeah. No, that's a really, really valid point.
Yeah. So I think there's room for all of it. And to some degree, it's what kind of practitioner do you want to be? Some people are very interested in public health. And the idea is I want to do as much as I can for as many people at least a minimal level to be helpful. And yes, acupuncture can do a lot in that regard. I happen to work in a way that I go, you know, because of the way that I am, I need to go slower and I need to kind of know the terrain of my patient before I know what to do. Again, there are probably other practitioners way better at certain diagnostics, and they would work in a whole different way than me.
Yeah, there are multi-bed practitioners, aren't mm-hmm. there? And there are one-on-one practitioners and a million different variations of both of those things. And our medicine does really allow us, going back to the point of individuality, to find a way of practicing that works for us.
Yes. And I think the only way that we get to really practice and do it for any length of time is if it is a fit for who we are.
Yes. Well, otherwise, I mean, we've been talking about burden, but I think we're both very clear that it's the level of burden we have, we are choosing to have, because we gain a lot more than we lose from the burden. And
well, and it's worth doing the hard work to be able to have the privilege of doing this work.
Yeah. And nothing comes, you don't get anything for free, as it were. If it were all easy and there were no burden, it wouldn't be as wonderfully satisfying and moving as it normally is.
Have you noticed that you just don't value free the way that you value something that you've had to work at acquiring?
Yeah, absolutely.
Free is a bad idea when I think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, both in sort of psychological terms and financial terms. I mean, I'm thinking of some kids I've treated who are very, very talented, naturally talented in a particular area. And I see very often them burdened by that, comparing that to a child who has decided that they want to be a footballer and has put in the hours and worked and worked and worked away in their back garden on their ball skills, and they get so much more out of than being on the football team than the one who's just naturally talented but who hasn't had to work for it and then feels it as a bit of a burden, really, and that they're a bit of a fraudster.
So I mentioned my 15-year-old niece, who is just a source of deep wisdom for me. We were talking about talent a little while back, and she said, how did she say this? She said, oh yes, well, you know, when you have talent, you have to work harder. And I was like, what? Most people think that when you've got talent, you got kind of a tailwind. You don't have to work as hard. She goes, well, that's right. That's why you have to work harder, or your talent will not come all the way out.
Mm-mm. She's very wise for a 15-year-old.
I suspect you, because you treat teenagers, you probably hear a lot of wisdom from young minds and hearts too, don't you?
Oh, I really do. Mm-hmm. Not just from teenagers, but from 5-year-olds. And you know, they really have an affinity. They look at my pictures on the wall of the five elements or the meridians or whatever, and they just respond to them in a very spontaneous, authentic way that makes me know they resonate with that way of understanding things.
You know, so much of our work, it really is about resonance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which could be a whole other conversation.
Yes.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for
you, Michael.
Coming back for this sort of part two. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, I've really appreciated the chance to talk about these things. I think they're really important that we talk about them.
Well, maybe more and more people will start talking about it. We'll see where these go.
Yeah, that would be really nice.
And so if someone wants to contribute to this book that you want to do.
Wait. You're putting me on the spot there.
All right. Well, let's just leave it as, it would be great if somebody works on a book called Errors in the Forest of Medicine, or Failures in the Forest of Medicine. That would be a great book.
Yeah, if someone wants to collaborate.
All right, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. We'll throw it out there and see what comes back.
Great. Anything else to add before we say goodbye for today?
I don't think so. I just think that to talk about any aspect of what we do that might burden us just feels really important. And I think I would want to encourage anyone listening to reflect on that, to help them, to enable them to go on doing the wonderful work that they're doing for longer and to thrive as they do it.
Beautifully spoken. All right, my friend, until next time then.